Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Attention returned to the war in Iraq this week when a website known as WikiLeaks released a leaked video of a U.S. military assault there that killed 12 people in 2007, including reporters from the Reuters News Service and innocent women and children. The tape is making waves because it appears to show innocent people being killed after soldiers mistook them for enemy fighters handling explosives. Apparently, the difference between camera equipment and explosives, for example, could not be clearly seen through their viewing devices from a helicopter, and the Americans fired. No one is claiming this was an intentional killing of innocents, but the video raises several troubling questions, like of how much certainty should be required before a military assault that is sure to result in the loss of life. And it shows the soldiers apparently reveling in hitting their human targets in a way that some are finding very distasteful. A related question comes up around one of the main weapons the Obama administration has been choosing to use in Afghanistan and Pakistan, unmanned drone attacks. These are supposed to be targeted assassinations of Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders, and reportedly they have been effective at finding their targets and killing many of the selected individuals. But the drones also claim civilian casualties, and they are extremely controversial, especially in Pakistan. In both cases, Iraq and Pakistan, firing from afar at targets that can't be completely isolated or identified. Slate.com's military columnist, Fred Kaplan, is with us. Fred writes the War Stories column for Slate, and his most recent book is 1959, The Year Everything Changed, which has nothing to do with the military, and in at least in Iraq. And New Yorker staff writer George Packer is also here. His blog covering foreign affairs, politics, and books is called Interesting Times, and he has a book, Interesting Times, Writing from a Turbulent Decade. George and Fred, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Fred. Hi, Brian.
And George was also on the panel at Cooper Union last night, built around Islamic studies professor Tariq Ramadan from Oxford, who was on our show yesterday, so we'll talk about that, too. I'll play some audio in a minute from the video released by WikiLeaks. But, George, tell us what you think is important here and what we learned by this release.
I think it's pretty much unprecedented, sort of unedited and highly graphic and highly disturbing material from what is actually not all that uncommon an incident. And that's why I think it's so important, because once you have Apaches in dense urban areas as part of a combat incident in an insurgency, where even from the ground it's very hard to know who are the insurgents and who are the civilians, that kind of thing became, and in Afghanistan is still, a almost built-in feature of our counterinsurgency tactics.
And so what we see on this tape is that it's a battle scene. It's shot from the vantage point, I believe, of the troops in the helicopter. It's intense for people not in war to see, though it may be, unfortunately, commonplace for people in war. It's a U.S. Army Apache helicopter in Baghdad in 2007, firing on a group of men that included a Reuters photographer and his driver, as it turned out, and then on a van that stopped to rescue some of the wounded. The more controversial shooting is actually the second one, which tragically turned out to be a man taking his two young children to a tutoring session. And the audio that we have from the tape is some of the troops in the helicopter asking for permission to engage, that is, to fire on that van. Listen.
Yep, he's got a weapon too. Hotel 26, Crazy Horse 18, have 5 to 6 individuals with AK-47s. Request permission to engage.
Roger that. We have no personnel east of our position, so you are free to engage. Over.
All right, we'll be engaging.
So, George Packer, maybe the most interesting part of that is that he was saying the individuals have weapons, AK-47s. I guess that turned out not to be the case?
Well, actually, I think that that bit of audio comes from the earlier part of the incident.
Correct.
When the Apaches were preparing to fire on the group of men
who they
saw walking toward the scene of a firefight. And that's what the video doesn't tell you, and the producers of the video don't tell you, that just about 100 meters away, insurgents and American soldiers were fighting, and that those Apaches were not just hovering over looking for anybody who looked suspicious. They were there under the command of the battalion that was engaged, and they were providing air support for the ground troops. And that's why Hotel 26, who's on the radio, is the ground officer who's telling the guy in the helicopter that we're not right there, so you can open up. But they were about 100 meters away, which means this was an ongoing firefight and not just a Pacific day, with nothing happening.
So
and
they
that,
were
that's
wrong.
What you don't know from the video.
They were wrong in what they thought they saw in this case, but the context was that there was a battle going on around them. However,
wait, Brian. Just they were not entirely wrong. There's an RPG and there's an AK-47, one of each on two different men. There's also a bunch of unarmed guys. So it's a mix of armed and unarmed men and journalists. And so it's a confused group.
And the Pentagon first reported that some of who turned out to be the victims were taking hostile action. And some of the anger around the video is that the video seems to reveal that they were not. Whether they had an AK-47 and an RPG or not, they were not using it at that moment, as the Pentagon apparently originally claimed in defending the incident. So is this, some proof that the Pentagon is lying to the public about incidents that we couldn't tell the difference if they were lying or not?
Yeah, that sounds at the very least like a misleading account of the incident. But if you've got guys with weapons walking toward the scene of a firefight, they're part of that incident. I mean, they don't get to be considered non-combatants until they open fire. So it's a grayer area than a lot of people think from just looking at that video and not noticing that some of them are armed. But I think you're absolutely right that the Pentagon's account of it was misleading, and the Pentagon's two-year attempt to keep this video from seeing the light of day was a kind of cover-up.
Let's turn to the drones, and we'll come back and see if anything connects these two stories, and turn to Fred Kaplan from Slate. Fred, for people who don't know, what kind of device is this unmanned drone, and how does it get sent to its targets in Afghanistan and Pakistan? Fred, you there? All right, we can't hear Fred Kaplan. I don't know if he can hear us. So, George Packer, I'll ask you about the drones.
I don't know a whole lot about the drones. Jane Mayer, my colleague here at The New Yorker, has written about it in the magazine. They're unmanned planes equipped with Hellfire missiles that are controlled from far, far away in the United States, and that have been heavily used, in fact, more heavily by the Obama administration than by the Bush administration, in targeting suspected Al-Qaeda and Taliban, especially leaders in the tribal areas, which are pretty much inaccessible certainly to American ground troops.
And the Obama administration is using these much more than the Bush administration did, especially since the bombing of an American CIA compound in Afghanistan in December. Listeners, I know there's been a lot of comment in many circles, certainly on a lot of websites that I look at, with respect to the morality of the drone attacks. Is this something you've been following? Listeners, 212-433-WNYC. Do you have an opinion about this? 212-433-9692. Or the WikiLeaks video, is this a tragic but probably unavoidable kind of incident in the fog of war, or is it something more outrageous than that, in your opinion, if you've been following the WikiLeaks video story? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for George Packer from The New Yorker and Fred Kaplan from Slate. And, Fred, I think we have you back now, right?
Yeah, I could hear you the entire time, so I know what you've been talking about.
Okay, so on the drones, which the Obama administration is using much more than the Bush administration mm-hmm. did, why have they stepped it up?
Well, for one thing, that they're available. These are fairly new technologies, that they're about that they vary in size. Some are about as big as a very big model airplane, and some are as big as a small airplane. I mean, they're really quite big. They're controlled literally by joystick with a monitoring screen from as far away as Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. There are now, I think, about 54 of these things up in the air over Afghanistan or in Iraq and maybe other places at any one time. Not all of them are armed. Most of them are used for surveillance, for, you know, a soldier on the ground wants to know if there are any IEDs around or if there's any enemies up ahead. They become not only incredibly invaluable to troops on the ground, but this is the face of the new Air Force. Brian, last year, for the first time, the Air Force trained more drone joystick pilots than they did airplane pilots. If you look at their recruitment literature, at their advertising, and their own genuine vision of where things are going, they are seeing this as the new elite combat force for the Air Force. For a while, they required for these joystick pilots to at least have been certified as airplane pilots. That requirement is being dropped. That was almost kind of like a union rule. This is, you know, like it or not, this is the new face of combat, or at least American combat.
How precise can a drone be when controlled from perhaps Nevada, flying over Pakistan, in hitting a person it's after without killing innocent civilians in the bargain?
Certainly no less accurate than somebody flying in a helicopter or an airplane overhead. They're looking at a very high-resolution video footage that's being taken by cameras on the belly of these things. But, you know, here is where you get into an issue that is not new, that has been the case even since the Yugoslav war. That is, you know, these weapons are incredibly precise. You know, I'm within a few feet of the target. This lends an illusion, though, that the war itself is very controllable and that you have perfect understanding of what's going on the ground. Therefore, whereas in the old days, before these smart bombs, you wouldn't have even thought to start bombing urban targets, especially in a counterinsurgency war where you're trying to win over the people, mm-hmm. because you would inevitably kill lots of people all the time. These accurate weapons give you the impression that you can control things. And so you do go into cities. Mistakes are inevitably made, if not by the occasional errant missile, then by, you know, human error. And you end up killing quite a number of people anyway.
And they're using it with what they consider much success because they are assassinating top leaders of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, who they were not able to get to before. But I gather that this has also become a big issue in Pakistan. Most Americans don't know about the drones, but
right.
from what I've been reading, this is a serious political issue causing a lot of resentment of the United States, correct?
Well, that's certainly true. But, you know, one thing needs to be kept in mind. They can't admit this, but the Pakistani government and the intelligence services and the military in Pakistan have to have approved what's going on. This is, I mean, it's inconceivable that this would keep going on at the rate that it is going on. And by the way, in his first year, Obama fired twice as many of these things as Bush did in his last year.
How many is that, roughly? Do you know how many that is?
Yeah, it's about 65 uh-huh. in 2009 versus Bush's 36 in 2008.
So
killing, you know, 500 and some militants as opposed to 200 and some.
So we have the Iraq situation. We have the Pakistan situation. George Packard, do you think they're related in some way? I mean, do they raise a common issue of the morality of using, firing at all where civilian casualties are likely or possible, or where there's great uncertainty in what you're seeing?
Absolutely. They raise the same issue. I actually think the risk of civilian casualties is much higher in the incident that WikiLeaks released than in the drone attacks, which are in much less populated areas and with actually a better technology, even though the control is in Nevada. And in fact, they have been devastatingly accurate, and pretty much everyone in Pakistan admits that they have really hurt the ranks of the senior Taliban leadership. But yeah, they raise the same question, which is, you know, although slightly different in the sense that in Iraq, as I said, those Apaches were in support of ground troops. And so they're not simply looking for targets in the way that the drones fly around looking for targets. They were, in a sense, taking the heat off ground troops and improving their chances of surviving a firefight. So there's a really difficult moral issue for the military, and do you expose your troops to greater risk on the ground and call off the Apaches in order to prevent the likelihood of civilian casualties? So it's American lives and Iraqi lives which are in the balance here. I think the issue for the drones is not the same, but the basic issue of is, you know, because we have the technology, does that mean we should use it when we're fighting insurgencies which are extremely difficult to distinguish from the civilian population? And also from a strategic point of view, the moral point of view is important, but let's talk about the strategy. And this is what Stanley McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, has been just obsessed with. You know, you kill civilians, you don't just commit a terrible moral offense. You also antagonize a whole population, which is part of, you know, which is the center of gravity, as they say in the military, of the conflict. So it's almost like you may be winning that little battle, you're losing the war. And I actually wonder if what those Apaches did in Baghdad in 2007 would even be permissible under the rules of engagement that Stanley McChrystal has imposed in Afghanistan, which are actually much tighter because he has made civilian casualties, you know, a top priority.
We'll continue in a minute with Fred Kaplan from Slate, George Packer from The New Yorker on the firing incidents in both Iraq and Afghanistan, Pakistan. And we'll take your phone calls. We have a very full board and people calling in to talk about both of these things and the questions both of morality and strategy. 212-433-WNYC, but our lines are full. You can also comment on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. On WNYC, as we talk about the rules of engagement when firing from afar, with George Packer from The New Yorker and Fred Kaplan from Slate and Syed in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling us.
Thank you for taking my call, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
My comment towards the drone attacks is that I think it's a very destructive policy because if we are trying to win the hearts and minds of the people over there, and on the same time, we are attacking them from drones. This just creates, I think it creates more hate and more disgust towards the American forces. And so when you create such a disconnect between the people who are killing and the people who are getting killed, it's not good for anyone. I mean, at least the forces who are fighting on the ground, they know what's going on. They know where they're fighting, but the people who are sitting all the way on the other side of the world, they have no idea what's going on the other side.
Syed, I've read that leaders of Pakistan, though they won't say it publicly, may support this because it is killing some of the most feared Pakistani Taliban leaders as far as the government is concerned, and that it does have a unique ability to do it without more civilian casualties, as George was describing. Does that mitigate it at all for you?
No, even though the government is supporting it, but still the people are against it. And the point is that you're trying to win the hearts and minds of the people. This is the counterintuitive policy because I don't think that it's very beneficial to the forces on the ground because it is creating such disgust that it's very hard for the people who are there to win hearts and minds.
Syed, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Kevin in Carroll Gardens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how are you, Brian?
Good, and I understand you're an Iraq war vet?
Yes, that is correct. I'm a veteran from Iraq, and so speaking from a soldier's perspective, I can say one of the, not about the drones, but about the helicopter pilots, one of the issues that I find or that I found with soldiers is this anxiety or this anxiousness to just want to get engaged into in a firefight. You're there for, or one is there for 12 months, and the enemy is nowhere to be found. And when you find an opportunity, it's so tempting to shoot first and ask questions later. And I think that was one of the major issues with that helicopter engagement, especially with the van. Sorry?
Can I ask, when were you in Iraq?
I was there from 2003 to 2004 for the invasion, and then 2005 to 2006 during the insurgency and the Golden Mosque bombing.
And even in that phase, people were itching to get involved in a firefight?
Yeah. We would literally patrol the bad parts of the town and provoke firefights, provoke engagements. Drive around slowly. We would dismount our vehicles in the worst spots when we knew there were snipers in the area, just to get engaged in our firefight. And our own personal rules of engagement were, if we hear a shot or if we get shot at, to shoot into the buildings. In like
That changed dramatically soon after you left. When Petraeus came on board and the counterinsurgency doctrine became the new thing, that was strictly verboten. It became a when to shoot became a much more controlled thing.
All right, Kevin.
But I can certainly testify, having covered the war in Iraq, that Kevin is right. That when you're sitting around in the base all day and you go out on these patrols, and this is what you've been trained to do, it becomes almost a physical need to use your weapon, because otherwise there's a sense of, what are we doing here? The war is meaningless.
George Packer from The New Yorker there, who has covered the war in Iraq, as he was saying, also the author of the Interesting Times blog and a book called Interesting Times. Fred Kaplan, military affairs columnist for Slate, writes the War Stories column and is author of 1959, The Year That Changed Everything. By the way, listeners, if you want to see a picture of a drone, if you haven't seen one, we've put a photo of what's called a Global Hawk drone on our website. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show. And George, here's a comment coming in on our website. Perry writes, to repeat, the cover-up is the real story with respect to the Iraq video. And the WikiLeaks team has been saying as much. Nevertheless, the press has been focusing only on the incident and not on the cover-up. Do you agree that the cover-up is the real story or the more important story here?
Isn't it always? I mean, isn't that what we learned from Watergate? I think so, although failure to release a video and cover-up are not quite the same thing. If we can find a pattern of misleading or false statements from the military and suppression of material that should be publicly released, then I think you can call it a cover-up.
What do you think the policy should be? I mean, in this case, two of the dead were staffers for Reuters, the news service, and Reuters has been asking for access to this video, since I guess they knew a video existed, since the incident took place in 2007, and the military has been saying no.
Somebody
leaked it to WikiLeaks. But as a matter of policy, why should they deny Reuters the video?
I think you're right. I think they shouldn't. I think, first of all, it seems as if the military is hiding something, which they were, and I think Reuters and the families of the victims have a right to know what happened. So I absolutely agree. I want to just go back to something Syed said. He said that ground troops know what's happening and those in the air don't. He's absolutely right. And in a sense, you're almost fighting two different wars, depending on whether you're in the air or on the ground. And over the years, I saw the ground troops learning at such a rate what worked and what didn't, you know, what kind of war it was, who the enemy was, who the civilian population was. Whereas those in the air, it's basically it's a mechanical war. It's an engineering war. And it's a war that Donald Rumsfeld was much more comfortable fighting. And there was almost like a cultural split between air and ground forces. And really, it was the ground forces, the infantrymen, who learned the hard way how we could possibly salvage a terrible situation in Iraq. And they sometimes expressed resentment about those in the air who didn't have to, in a sense, live with the consequences of what their weaponry was doing.
Fred called it a video game war. Do you think that's too pejorative?
Well, I mean, certainly from Nevada it is.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, if you're in an Apache over Baghdad, it doesn't quite feel that safe and detached.
But, this has been the cultural split between ground forces and air forces going back since 1947 when the Air Force split away from the Army as a separate service. The blue boys flying up above, going back to their nice officers' quarters afterwards while the grunt, tries to get some sleep under a tree in the rain. This has long been the case, and it's part of the divide of the war.
But in this case, it's deep because the ground forces actually talk to Iraqis, which the air forces never
right.
do. And
in the
video, there's a moment when one of the infantrymen realizes that there were children in that van, and he grabs one of them and starts running to evacuate the child to a hospital, and his voice is actually breaking over the radio. His emotion is entirely the opposite of the kind of detached and rather cruel joking going on up in the cockpit, and that shows you what a gap there is between those two different kinds of force.
That's absolutely true.
James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks for calling.
And to the guests as well. I'm a former Army officer, and I was at one point a fire support officer. I didn't serve in Iraq or Afghanistan. I got out of the Army just before that happened, actually. But I probably did the job that's close to the Hotel 26 call sign that you hear in the footage over the radio, and that's the person on the ground that is speaking from the ground troops to the aircraft, mm-hmm. telling them where targets would be or where their friendlies were. And I would tell you that if I was that fire support officer on the ground, and the pilot came to me and said, "Hey," and put it in terms of a question, I have a group of men headed towards your location or near your location within 100 meters, and I think I see AK-47 and RPG. My feeling as a fire support officer would be like, "Well, I'm in an engagement, and those people, I don't get the luxury of coincidence, and those people are either coming towards me or could possibly come towards me. And, just because every single one of them is not carrying AK-47 RPG does not mean, and we've seen this in other wars past Somalia and other places where the weapons were shared. When an enemy soldier is taken down, the weapon is passed on. That's one of the reasons why those people were there, is sort of an empty-handed reinforcement. That's not the luxury that I would, as my job as a fire support officer, of coincidence. I would say, you need to engage them. You need to keep them away from the fight that I'm in right now with my infantry guys. And the other thing that you have to consider is in the gun camera footage, it's very myopic. You're only seeing what the gun camera sees. You're not seeing what the pilots in the aircraft are seeing around the aircraft, almost to 180 degrees around them. And that's one of the important things that we have to see. I do not believe that it should have been covered up or in any way, but it is a gun camera. It's not a guy walking around with a cell phone or a video camera on YouTube. It may very well be classified information. It's from a weapon system. It's from an aircraft. In situations like this, we have to be very careful not to lay it all at the doorstep of the Pentagon, saying that it's their fault that this happened.
George, do you want to react?
Yeah, I think I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
James.
I mean, you're really articulate about the situation of the ground soldier, and that's what the WikiLeaks video leaves out. And I don't know whether it left it out in order to push the viewer into an emotion of absolute rejection of what he or she is seeing, or whether they decide simply we're going to show what the gun camera sees and nothing else. But it's a symptom or a sign of how limited such a video is, and what a limited view of a war it gives you, because the position of the American troops nearby is a huge factor in what those pilots are doing. I hated their crosstalk while they were doing it, but it's not hard to imagine, if you put yourself in their position, that they're up there in support of an ongoing incident, and that if they simply say, well, we can't be sure, we see an RPG and an AK-47, but there's other people too, they're actually, in a sense, abandoning their comrades on the ground to their fate. And so that's what the video left out. It was too narrow a view of that incident to tell you exactly what to think. It told you part of what to think, but not exactly what to think.
James, with your experience in this firsthand and knowing the uncertainties involved, how would you set the rules of engagement?
I don't think that you can change, Brian, the rules that are in place. I mean, it is warfare and it is combat. And if you continue to try and narrow and pinpoint, for instance, go towards, I cannot engage unless every guy in that group has a weapon, it puts our soldiers in a very dangerous position. I think that in, you know, urban conflict, especially with the you know, very low, very short standoff ranges, very limited sight, you can't see everything, especially inside or between buildings, mm-hmm. or a street or an alleyway. If you continue to narrow the ability for our soldiers to engage, you know, we keep going that direction, they're going to be helpless.
And I've heard criticism already, from some commentators in the press that the McChrystal Obama rules of engagement for Afghanistan now have become too cautious in the name of preserving civilian life, and that it's risking the lives of U.S. soldiers as a result, or also hampering the ability to win the war. Do you share that opinion, James?
You know, I'm not there anymore, and I'm not the soldiers that are practicing those rules of engagement. There can be that danger, but I will have to say that regardless of what anyone thinks, I don't think I ever knew a soldier that I served with or served under me or over me that did not, you know, value civilian human life to the fullest. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any, well, I can't say that statement like that, but at least me, I would never want to engage, and I could never live with myself if I engaged somebody that was innocent, that had nothing mm-hmm. to do with the fight.
I understand what you're saying. You don't get the luxury of always making that judgment in the heat of battle, right?
It's a tough call. It's a tough call for police in New York as well. I mean, but, it happens in any place that people carry guns for a living, and it's unfortunate.
But you did go from saying nobody you ever have known in the military relishes this to saying, well, at least you don't. So.
Well, obviously the military is a very big place, yeah. And soldiers are under a lot of stress.
And James, thank you for your service, and thank you for your call.
Thank you, Brian.
And we just have a couple of minutes left with Fred Kaplan and George Packer, and I actually want to change directions for our last few minutes because, George, you were on that panel last night, right, at Cooper Union with Tariq Ramadan, the renowned and controversial Islamic studies professor from Oxford, who was just admitted back into this country after a six-year ban. And we spent about a half hour on the air with Professor Ramadan yesterday before the panel. One of the controversies around him is whether he's really moderate, as he often sounds like, or if he's playing a double game, saying things that more radical Muslim followers know that he really means. And here's about a 40-second clip of Tariq Ramadan from yesterday's show, where I asked him about Islamic rule as applied in the governments of the Taliban and Saudi Arabia, for example.
Muslims in the contemporary world, not only in the West, but wherever they are, they have to deal with, you know, contemporary issues. We have many interpretations. We have the same sets of texts, but we have many interpretations. So Muslims should accept this diversity. It goes from literalists to reformists. I'm from the reformist trend, and we have to understand this, and we have to be critical. But for all of us, ordinary citizens, as well as, you know, scholars, essentialization is dangerous. To say, oh, this is what is happening in the name of Islam. It means that Islam is this. I think that this no one would do this with Christianity, Judaism, or even a secular ideology.
So when he says essentialization, he was saying don't judge Islam or Islamic government in general from the few bad examples that we have today, like Saudi Arabia and the Taliban. How'd that go on the panel last night?
Yeah, that question came up. Actually, I asked him essentially a philosophical question. Where do our rights come from? Do they come because they're inherent in being human, or do they come from these texts? And I think he believes, as he said to you, that they come from the text. And for me, that's very problematic because that means they're open to the interpretation of this or that religious scholar, and they can be given and taken away. But I don't think he does play a double game, and I said that last night. I think he really does say the same thing to every audience, and he is a moderate, and his project in Europe is to make it possible for young Muslims to retain a strong sense of their faith and their identity while being good citizens of secular democracies. However, that sort of effort at a bridge is built on a foundation that I find very problematic. And I talked about that last night. I asked him some tough questions about his grandfather, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and some pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic associations and statements of his. And that was the limit. Tariq Ramadan would not go there. He wouldn't, in a sense, acknowledge and condemn that in his own origins and the origins of the Brotherhood, which was his sort of milieu growing up, have poison in them. And I mentioned a new book by Paul Berman called The Flight of the Intellectuals, which makes this case at length. And so I think intellectually and in terms of his background and his sort of the limits of what he's willing to say and think, there is a problem with Tariq Ramadan. But that problem is not the work he's doing mm-hmm. with young Muslims in Europe. I think that's good work and constructive work, and it's better than most of the alternatives.
All right, Fred, I'm going to throw one breaking news story at you here before you both go. This just in from the AP. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, the court's oldest member and leader of its liberal bloc, says he is retiring. This has been speculated on, of course, for weeks now, but President Obama has his second high court opening to fill. You see a battle ahead?
Yeah, sure. There's always a battle ahead. Why not? But I think they're ready for it. I mean, Stevens has been signaling for many months now through a big profile in The New Yorker and another one in The New York Times that, he's going to leave, partly because he wants Obama to be president when his seat comes open. So I'm sure, I don't know who they are. I don't have these kinds of sources, but I'm sure that the White House has scoped this out pretty thoroughly already. I mean, they're not going to put Lawrence Tribe on the court because that would cause too much of a fight. But it's a balance. Let's find somebody who reflects our views, but who also isn't going to get defeated.
All right, another summer of Supreme Court nominee debate. We had it last year with Sonia Sotomayor. We'll have it this year again with somebody, John Paul Stevens, announcing his retirement 11 days before his 90th birthday. Just in. Fred Kaplan from Slate, George Packer from The New Yorker, thank you both so much.
Anytime, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.